We gather to seek, to find, and to share the promise of honest religion. And so it is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. Vulnerability more powerful than strength. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. Please join with me in an attitude of meditation and prayer. We come here each Sunday hoping to catch a glimpse of truth. And like the blind men who each touched a different part of the elephant, we each see something different, and yet something that in its essence partakes of the greater truth that we all one day hope to see in its entirety. But we are like fish who swim through the water, not even realizing there is water. We are all too often on autopilot, passing through the days like a fish passes through the water. May we have the wisdom, the consciousness, and the courage to open our eyes and see the water and understand how we flow through it on our journey towards truth. Amen. It is always a privilege to be here. I listened to the numbers that Brendan was saying, and they just can't be right. We have to be in a parallel universe or something. And speaking of which, I don't think I can be quite as dramatic as the Peridot players today, but I have to say that when I heard the line about the split infinitive, I thought of my favorite split infinitive of all time, and one of the most famous split infinitives of all time, and that is the split infinitive that occurs at the end of the introduction to Star Trek, where they say, to boldly go where no man has gone before. And the Star Trek movie's out right now, and you know, Gene Roddenberry, many, many years ago, actually apologized to the American Association of Teachers for for putting that on TV. Anyway, it's not good to have to start a talk by asking the indulgence of your audience, but you might be able to hear it. I have a bit of a cough, and I hope that you'll bear with me. I have been thinking about the relationship between the values of our society and the choices afforded to us by that society for a number of years. In many ways, I think we have reached a crossroads with respect to both our values and our choices as a nation, as a church, and as individuals. There is an old Chinese curse that goes like this: may you live in interesting times. Well, we cannot choose the times, but man, they sure are interesting. Those of you who know me know my love of pop culture. I just demonstrated it. So I was especially excited last week when the sermon was entitled The Gospel According to Monty Python. Now, I'm a big fan of the Pythons, and I have every episode of that show on DVD. The Pythons certainly poked fun at society, and by implication, our values. But today, I'm going to start off with a different pop culture reference, the animated TV show Family Guy. How many of you know that show? I expect that a few in this church might know Family Guy. It's quite irreverent, perhaps even subversive, in its parody of nostalgic values that the people think that they remember from the old days, and in particular, I think, the supposed halcyon days of America during the 1950s. So in the opening jingle of the show, which is itself a takeoff from All in the Family, Lois, who is married to the Family Guy, complains that, quote, it seems today that all you see is violence in movies and sex on TV, unquote. And then Peter, her husband, the Family Guy, responds, quote, but where are those good old-fashioned values on which we used to rely, unquote. We are then told that luckily there's a Family Guy who can positively bring back and live those values. Not. The point of the show is that this is definitely not the case. And if you know the show, then you know that if it were possible to be more than 180 degrees away from that guy, that's where Peter would be. One need not pay too much attention to pop culture for a very long time to come away with the impression that America is obsessed with values. It seems like one can't go for more than a few hours without hearing about this or that development in the culture wars. For example, just the other day, the Supreme Court of California confirmed Proposition 8's ban on same-sex marriage in that state, while at the same time affirming all the marriages that had occurred before the deadline. President Obama's pick for the United States Supreme Court, Sonia Sotomayor, is already under scathing attack from the right and will certainly be grilled about her views on abortion, stem cell research, and other signal issues. The culture wars are emblematic of a development in our country that we all know too well, the polarization of just about everything between the right and the left. There are hundreds of examples, of course, but I think that the almost nightly battle between MSNBC on the one hand and Fox News on the other provides not just an example of how polar we have become, but also just how mean-spirited, shrill, and relentless. Sometimes I just want to be left alone, you know? Part of the problem is that I believe that over the last century or so, and definitely within my lifetime and the lifetime of most of you, our lives and the forces that shape our lives have changed so much and so rapidly that many of the values, expectations, and understandings that sustained us in the past are simply not enough or of little or no applicability. And I believe much of the blame, frankly, lies in our devotion to the concept of individual choice and all the hard work we have done in the last handful of decades to increase the available choices and the number of people who could enjoy them. Let me explain. The concept of individual choice, and by that I mean the freedom to choose so many of the aspects of how we live our lives, lies at the very heart of our society. From the question, what do you want to be when you grow up, to the constitutionally sanctioned right of privacy that protects a woman's right to be left alone in her reproductive choices, we Americans decide for ourselves almost everything about how we want to live our lives. And the trend over the last half century in particular has been to provide increasingly more choice for increasingly more people. Have you ever stopped to think about the choices we have here in the beginning of the 21st century and how to live our lives? Just think about the unbelievable number of consumer choices we have and how they are presented to us on a silver platter of temptation by the media, advertisers, and the like. The truth is even that with the financial collapse of last year, an ordinary middle-class American has more great stuff to choose from than most any king in history. Any king of any country on earth for the last several millennia of Western civilization would turn green with envy over the choices we have in our day-to-day living. But there are so many other choices we have just besides consumer choices. We have at our disposal an incredible array of choices for living that both span and define a lifetime. I'd wager that something approaching 90% of all jobs and careers didn't exist in 1876, which was when the Texas Constitution was drafted. There was nothing in telecommunications, nothing in electronics, nothing in aviation, nothing in automobiles, nothing in psychiatry or psychology. Nothing in television, nothing in the movies, nothing in space technology, nothing in refrigeration, nothing in plastics, nothing in, well, you get the idea. The choices most people now have for how to live their lives are nothing short of overwhelming, and they are increasing every day. The pace of change in our country over the last century, and certainly within my lifetime, has simply been incredible. We have experienced in a single lifetime changes that used to take several or even many generations to manifest. The easiest example is the election of President Obama. But how about the huge change in the role of women and their increasing independence, both financial and biological, independence that allows them to make choices for themselves that were unheard of in our recent past? How about the rise of meritocracy, something that was talked about in the little bit of the play we saw? The rise of meritocracy so that people are judged on their merits rather than their parentage, ethnicity, or economic status. How about the opening up of the free marketplace of ideas through the democratization of just about everything, something that has had a tremendous influence on culture, especially since the advent of the internet and blogging and all the other things just in the last 10 to 12 years? And finally, how about the fact that our culture has, at least officially, redefined itself in the last half century to be much more accepting of diversity, whether of race, ethnicity, religious belief, gender, or sexual preference? Now, I'm not standing up here telling you that the job is done. It isn't done, not by a long shot. But no one can say that our cultural landscape has not been forever altered, or that freedom of choice and the opportunity to fully participate in our society hasn't come to millions who were in the shadows before. This sort of rapid change, even when the changes are good, can result in dislocation and shock. In fact, I believe that many of these changes have, in many ways and for many people, created large disruptions in almost every aspect of life you can think of. In this regard, I am thinking of the book Future Shock, which was written by Alan Toffler in the 60s, in which he posited that there could be, quote, too much change in too short a period of time, unquote, and that it could result in discomfort and upset. I suspect that there is a bit of this going on today. And I can't imagine that cultural norms and societal values could have kept up with the incredible changes we just talked about. In fact, I found an article on the internet, of course, that tends to support this conclusion. It seems that researchers from several universities have found that while our ability to weigh choices and to distinguish choices is a remarkably advantageous ability, it also comes with some liabilities. It turns out that people faced with numerous choices, whether good or bad, find it difficult to stay focused enough to complete projects, handle daily tasks, or even take their medicine. Too much choice can be overwhelming, and in certain areas, leave us positively at a loss to know what to do and what is right and what is wrong. Now, I was thinking of all of the choices we have for our lives and the rapidity with which they have come to us, and I was wondering, besides our angst at the grocery store trying to decide which of the dozens of kinds of cereal to buy, was there any other price that we had paid for these choices? What, if anything, was the price for all the freedom and all the choices that we have? And what occurred to me was a very simple but nonetheless important relationship between values and choices. I realized that values and choices go together and that they are related. This relationship is easily stated. The stronger and more concrete your values, the fewer choices you have in how to live your life. The more flexible your values, or not having them at all, the more choices you have your life. It's really that simple. Thus, in order for society and our culture to sustain the incredible freedom of choice we have, the array of possibilities, lifestyles, opportunities, and the like, our overarching cultural values must allow for the flexibility, tolerance, and neutrality necessary in order to make it work. And I'm coming to the conclusion that this inverse relationship holds the key to much of what was previously a mystery to me. Let me give you an example of what I mean as it relates to our religion. In our Unitarian religion, it is both unimportant and in some deep sense irrelevant whether or not you believe in God. This lack of a value proposition for God provides members of our church with the ability to believe a vast array of things about themselves and their relationship to the cosmos. Theists and atheists sit side by side without rancor. Contrast this state of affairs with a fundamentalist church. There, of course, the value proposition is that there is one God, one Savior, Jesus Christ, and there is hence only one choice, belief in the God of fundamentalism. It is their way or the highway. In this regard, you would expect that the sermons in a fundamentalist church would tend to focus on salvation through Jesus and that the laws of God as set forth in the Bible. I decided to test this hypothesis, so I went online and sampled some sermons about Jesus and the little children. I hope you all know that parable. And as I expected, I got a bunch of sermons that were all pretty much the same. There was a uniformity of message, and they provided a consistent and secure message. Contrast that with Unitarian sermons. We have sermons on subjects from A to Z, from atonement to how zebra's stripes are a metaphor for racial equality. In fact, Unitarians talk about everything under the sun because we have to. Virtually everything is in play in our religion. This distinction is also seen in evangelizing. A fundamentalist can brag about eternal life being bestowed for a mere prayer and how living the good life, the life of God, is as easy as following God's laws as explained in the Bible. But we Unitarians don't have a book. We have hundreds or even thousands of books. And we don't have many, one is tempted to say, any universal answers. We really can't proselytize. What are we going to say? We really don't know exactly what we're doing yet, and most of us have different ideas of how to travel down the path of life. But we're working really hard to figure it out, so come join us. And remember to bring something to share. Is it any wonder why we are so few in number? Now, all joking aside, really, if you're going to be into choice, and in this case, individual religious choice, there is no better place for you than right here in this church, something you all already know, I'm sure. Because the requirement, because besides a requirement to be more or less well-mannered and fair, there is almost unlimited choice in one's religious convictions and the paths along which to explore them. Here, then, are two religious extremes, one with almost no choice and a hard and set fast set of rules and values, and the other with virtually unlimited choice and few hard and fast requirements for belief and behavior. And here, then, is the key to understanding how both of these diametrically opposed institutions survive in society. In order to accommodate both Unitarianism and fundamentalism, the culture must be tolerant and neutral and may not take a stand one way or the other. And obviously and of course, that's precisely what we have in this country with our constitutionally prescribed separation of church and state. Now, what I'm suggesting to you today, and see if this doesn't make sense, is that something similar has happened across the board to every value-laden proposition you can think of. In order for the freedoms and choices that exist around those topics, and you can take your pick, in order for them to flourish, the overarching values of the culture had to change, and moreover had to become more flexible and tolerant, whatever those values might have been in the context of the choices made. Furthermore, the pursuit of individual choice as the ultimate freedom has, I think, in many ways and on every level, created a highly balkanized, disunited, polarized culture that, for the reasons I just talked about, provides many people out there with the foundation of jello. In short, we really are not one nation under God, at least not anymore. The truth is that freedom by itself is neither a very good unifying force nor a good moral compass for determining what is right and wrong. In fact, the more freedom a group of people have, the less unified they are likely to become because of the myriad of possibilities and the diversity of personal choice. If, as they say, the proof is in the pudding, then the polarization of our nation, and in particular our political discourse, Over the last handful of decades, as our personal freedoms and choices have expanded and spread, is certainly proof. Another aspect of freedom that we never talk about is that without boundaries, without canalizing rules, freedom can degenerate into chaos, something I submit has happened to many people over the last few decades. The pace of life, the complexities of life, even the choices of life have become so overwhelming that it is hard to keep up, hard to stay grounded, hard to know just what to do. Now, it is important here to distinguish between cultural values and personal values. I do believe that we live in a society that has, at the highest levels, become increasingly valueless in order to accommodate an ever-increasing array of choices and diversity of every kind, but also one in which almost everyone craves values. On the one hand, the government and the culture itself must be as flexible as possible in terms of their sanctioned values in order for each individual to make his or her own subjective choices and to accommodate the diversity of beliefs and life paths. But on the other hand, however, choices are not made in a vacuum. There has to be some framework, some foundation, some set of reasons upon which to make these choices. So we have a bit of a paradox here, I think. An increasingly valueless or value-neutral society, but increasingly value-starved individuals trying to make important choices without strong societally sanctioned guidance. There are, in fact, local, diverse, and decentralized individual value sources, but they primarily serve to support subjective individual choices, not to provide cultural norms. And let me suggest to you again that the very diversity and polarized nature of the many sources of values we see in our society, in particular on the right and on the left, would tend to support this very conclusion. Now, I suspect that not very many of you in here today are very bothered by all of this. And the reason I say that is that Unitarians are the champions of individual choice, and we are quite used to dealing with a plethora of possibilities. But honestly now, if everyone had strong cultural values to draw upon, do you think they would call Dr. Laura or some other authority by the thousands to find out how to behave? Even worse, how about all those souls who call the psychic hotlines, trusting to a disembodied voice to mystically decide for them what they should do in important life issues? Do you think these people feel well-grounded and confident about themselves and the world? And I'm sure that you can easily come up with a few examples of your own. When we contrast all of this with a nostalgic view of the 1950s as the time of perfect values, perfect suburban lives, and the peak of the American dream, it is easy to see how people, especially conservatives and the religious right, could find solace in that view and wish for its return. And we have to admit that there is tremendous power in that myth, for it is truly a nostalgic myth, but one that provides certainty, security, the promise of a good and godly life, a sense of community and coherence, and a return to the image of the American way as the best and brightest way, a way approved by God. It was the power of nostalgia, that allowed then-candidate for president Ronald Reagan to talk about an America he believed existed, quote, "When I was young and when this country didn't know it had a race problem," unquote. And it certainly was the power of nostalgia that allowed Sarah Palin to take up Reagan's mantle of the mythologized Camelot of America. Moreover, while one may not like or accept the values of the fundamentalist Christian, those values provide a priori blessed guidance directly from God on how to behave. Not a heck of a lot of choice, maybe, but why does one need choice? Why does one need choice when God has provided a sacred set of rules and values? At least fundamentalists know in their hearts they are doing the right thing, even if we think that they are at best foolish and at worst dead wrong. So where does all this leave us? As I noted at the beginning of this sermon, I believe we are at an important crossroads for America and the future of freedom and individual choice. I know that we just elected a president who has inspired us with his audacity of hope. But at some level, I fear that this will fuel rather than quell the deep polarization that we are experiencing as a nation. Moreover, part of the danger I see is that it is precisely times like this when people crave certainty, security, and reassurance. That is what is offered by the conservative religious right. That and the promise of a return to glory. Our way, the way of this church, the way of individual choice and personal conscience, that way does not offer the kinds of certainty many people want. When we open our service, we say that our church is a place for questions more profound than answers. Well, I'm telling you, there are millions of people out there today who are looking for answers, and they are sick and tired of questions. They're scared. They are afraid of the future and what it might bring. And I can understand the pull of the right, the pull of the mythology of the 50s, the pull of a promise of security and certainty. But it is exactly at times like this when we need to hold fast and stick to our guns. I'll tell you that in many ways and for some years I have felt like I am in a humanist foxhole surrounded by those who would take away the hard-won freedoms of the last 50 years and replace the cultural accommodations that have been made with their own set of myths about God, God's laws, and as the Family Guy jingle says, those good old-fashioned values on which we used to rely. And so if there is a culture war going on, and I believe there is, then I think that it is the duty of each and every one of us to defend our church, our religion, and our way of life. I know most of you are of the live and let live school of life, but sometimes it is important and necessary to leave the safety of our sanctuary and take a stand for what we believe. And finally, although it is well beyond the scope of my talk today, I believe we Unitarians need to work hard to develop new values that will help to unite us as we travel down the path of our individual consciences. You know, I have always believed that our devotion to our individual consciences was both our greatest strength and our greatest weakness. I am not sure the Unitarian Church is quite like herding cats, but sometimes our strong sense of individualism can overpower our sense of community and our recognition of how much we need one another as we stand on the threshold of the unknown, of the future. This is especially important today, and it is especially important in this church, my church, the church I have been attending for 32 years and in which I have been doing sermons for 23. We are a great church, and we are good people. And now, when our collective need is greatest, we must somehow overcome the devotion to individualism that usually works so well for us, and instead work for the community, for the institution, for the future of this church and all it stands for. There is a lot of work to do, but I believe in our values and I have faith in our choices. I hope you do too. We leave this sacred time together. Our world needs us, and the spirit we carry forth.
Let us become the light, the truth, and the healing that we seek.
Amen.